we need to, I think, acknowledge the fact that when we did these slides a week ago, we didn't envisage the biggest news story to be about something which happened at the end of last week. So, with everything going on in the world at the moment, we think, we're living through history as it happens. And in terms of employment law, a lot of it is politically driven, is driven by changes and norms in society. And I think what's happened with the P&O decision last week too, effectively completely avoid going through the processes that are accepted for employers to deal with terminations of employees within is going to send shockwaves throughout the employment law community and will, long term result in substantial change. So for me, it's not too dissimilar from the Made in Dagenham strike of the Ford workers and the impetus that gave to the equal pay movement. There were already concerns about the hire and fire culture, and we were going to talk and are going to talk about a case involving Tesco that covers that later this morning. But the blatant disregard of Dubai ports and P&O ferries of the accepted norms for managing mass changes of employment is really just going to add fuel to the fire of concerns that the fire and rehire agenda isn't covered appropriately by UK law. So undoubtedly it's shameful. You can probably tell my slight embarrassment as an employment lawyer talking about it. I watched it and I've read the stuff through the cracks in my fingers, to be honest. But I think we will probably see the department BEIS taking enforcement proceedings, so the Insolvency Service taking enforcement proceedings against the directors of the business. They're probably going to potentially face disqualification charges. And I think, as in a lot of these sort of mass issues, the employees are caught in the middle, really, of what's going on. And even though they will win automatic unfair dismissal claims, they will also win protective award claims. Those will be 12, 18, 24 months down the line. And I think that the question as to whether there are legal avenues to give the protections needed to employees against the balance of being able to change things for employers will become a really hot debate. And I think the Tesco case indicates the way the courts are willing to intervene in the right circumstances. If you think about us compared to some of the European countries like France and Germany, there would probably have been an injunction to prevent what has gone on with P&O last week. And I could see the legislation as well as the fines and the penalties for taking this sort of action substantially increasing, also trying to increase the leverage for the courts to step in and stop these things happening, because, as I say, the effects on employees are long reached. And there's also the risk, depending on how these businesses have been set up, that they can be avoided even if there are substantial penalties through some form of insolvency proceedings. So it's a shambles. It's shameful, frankly. And I think we all have watched that with sort of dread on our minds. But I think watch this space, because undoubtedly that will be something that we'll be talking to you about as this year goes on and as we look to future changes. Otherwise, apart from that, it's been a reasonably quiet year. We've not had substantial amounts of VAT cases coming through. There's been a catch up in terms of the delays that there have been through the pandemic. But we will look at some cases which give indications of the way in which things are proceeding. And just looking at the list there, we look at work status cases, but that has a general effect on some of the holiday pay issues that we see. Thinking about the first instance decisions we're seeing about dismissal for mandatory vaccination refusals, and also later on about health and safety concerns during the pandemic and how they've been dealt with. And then talking about something we're seeing more and more frequently in practice, which is vexatious grievances or multiple grievances, probably, and the processes that are coming from those. Talking about that Tesco case on dismissal and re-engagement, which probably will then need to be revisited as we go through. And finally, we'll have a look at an associative discrimination claim, which is which I think is timely given the proposals around flexible working changes that we're seeing. So we're just going to move on to the first slide, which is about the legislation update, and Lisa's going to talk to you about the annual limits changes.
That's great. Thanks, Chris. Yes, so every April we tend to get increases to rates and limits, and this April is no different. So from the 6th of April 2022, we're going to see some increases to statutory maternity pay, statutory paternity pay, statutory adoption pay and shared parental leave pay. And that's going up to £156.66 per week. Equally, we're seeing an increase to the cap on a week's pay. So talking about P&O and redundancies, the cap on a week's pay for the purposes of, amongst other things, calculating statutory redundancy pay is increasing to £571 per week. And in turn, the statutory cap for unfair dismissal cases, so this is what applies to the compensatory award, is increasing to £93,878. We're also going to be having some increases to the national minimum wage, and they'll take effect from the 1st of April 2022. So the national living wage, which applies to those aged 23 and over, will increase from £8.91 to £9.50. I'm then just going to pass back to Chris, who's going to tell us about the immigration changes that we're anticipating.
Yeah, thanks. Some of them we've already seen. So from the 15th of February, care workers were added to the shortage occupation list, and provided a paid a minimum salary of £20,480, as long as the organisation has a sponsors licence. It enables changes, people to be brought in from outside of Great Britain and Ireland to carry out that work. It's an abbreviated, expedited process with lower application fees and without the immigration skills charge that applies for a number of areas. But that's a positive change. I think it comes after substantial lobbying. There's also lobbying going on in the hotels and restaurant industries, particularly in places like Cumbria, where staff shortages are still being felt acutely. And I think, given the way government policy tends to work under the Boris Johnson government, my guess is if we get some form of crisis over the summer or something that will deliver change, that change will also be likely to happen with some form of provision included for them. Other changes we're seeing from the 6th of April, for those of you that do use a sponsor's license and need to carry out right to work checks for non-UK and Irish nationals, or if you're recruiting somebody who has leave to enter already, you need to make the identity checks from the 6th of April. Again, we're slightly behind the curve in terms of the legislation and the practice following the timings that are involved. There will now be an online service using what they call identity document validation technology, which is going to be operated by a number of identity service providers, which will need to be used when checking the identity of people who either have barometric residence permits or frontier worker permits. So if you're employing somebody who is not a UK or Irish national, and you need to do checks after the 6th of April, you need to look at those provisions and think about how you're going to assess that. You will also be allowed to use those services once they're up and running to check UK and Irish national passports as well. But currently the right to work checks continue as they are. And there's been an extension of the COVID provision, which allow you to look at a scanned document rather than an original document. That's been extended from the 5th of April, when that was due to end, to the end of September, 30th September 2022. But over time, I think the move is going to be towards online checking, because that seemed to be a far more secure system. Just a reminder, without that, you don't have the statutory excuse about employing illegal workers and have a substantial potential liability per illegal worker. The other thing to come out of that legislation, which is helpful, I think, in some regards, is that for British citizens, you can use an expired passport to satisfy the right to work checks that you need to now make. So that was a problem, especially with delays and people not getting new passports during the pandemic. But they've confirmed now that an expired passport can be used. So some changes there. And again, we will see immigration practice grow. And our colleague Amy Surgeson, who deals with a lot of work in that area, will be giving you regular updates on what's happening across the course of this year.
And in terms of other statutory changes, we saw a government consultation last year in relation to sexual harassment in the workplace. We haven't seen much movement following the closure of that consultation, but we do now know that the Equality and Human Rights Committee has been given the green light by the government and is in the process of drafting a statutory code of practice on sexual harassment in the workplace, together with guidance for employers on how to effectively protect those at risk of harassment. So at the moment, the EHRC website has lots of information on there and really helpful guides on sexual harassment in the workplace, but currently they don't have statutory effect. So this will be a new code that will have statutory effect, but actually the EHRC website is a great source of free information if you are dealing with any discrimination issues or are wanting to look up best practice in the area. We'll let you know as and when that guidance comes out, and we'll do some LinkedIn posts, etc., about that. So watch that space. In addition, the flexible working changes are still expected. Again, there's been a bit of a delay on that. We've not seen much since the consultation, which we talked about in the last case law and legislation update that we did, which was called Making Flexible Working the Default, was the name of the consultation. That closed on the 1st of December 2021, but we're still awaiting a response. But there's no suggestion that that is going away or anything, and we think it is very much expected, but we've just have a bit of a lull for the time being. But again, keep an eye out on our LinkedIn posts and our e-newsletters, because as soon as we get any information on that, we will be updating you.
You've just muted there, Lisa.
Oh, sorry. So now on to the cases. So the first case that we'd like to talk to you about today is about worker status. And if you have watched any of our previous case law updates, worker status has been a bit of a running theme. And that's because it has been at the highest courts have been making decisions. And Smith and Pimlico Plumbers is a case that originally was reached all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that Mr. Smith, who was a plumber, and Pimlico Plumbers believed that he was purportedly a self-employed contractor, was found to be in fact a worker. So after that decision was handed down by the Supreme Court, the case was remitted back to the Employment Tribunal, because alongside the kind of main question of employment status, Mr. Smith was also claiming that he was entitled to, amongst other things, holiday pay. And this is what the focus of this case is about. So just kind of by way of a quick reminder, Gary Smith worked for Pimlico Plumbers between August 2005 and May 2011. Pimlico Plumbers, as I've said, said that he was self-employed. He did take holidays, but these were always unpaid. As I say, the Supreme Court held that Mr. Smith was in fact a worker, so it was remitted back to the Employment Tribunal to consider his holiday pay claim. The Employment Tribunal and the Employment Appeals Tribunal both rejected Mr. Smith's holiday pay claim. And on the basis that he had taken his holidays, even though he wasn't paid for them. Mr. Smith appealed, and it went to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal disagreed with the tribunal and the Employment Appeals Tribunal decision. The reason for this was that the lower courts had considered the case of King and Sash Windows, which we've talked about before, and if we cast our minds back, is a case which concerned a purported self-employed window salesman who was paid predominantly on the basis of commission. And he was never offered, and he never took any paid holiday pay. but he was successful in arguing when the employment or when the arrangement came to an end that he was in fact a worker, and he was successful in claiming that his holiday pay had accrued during the whole period that he worked for Sash Windows, and therefore he was found to be entitled to 13 years worth of paid leave under the Working Time Directive. So this case didn't concern any more generous contractual holiday or any statutory holiday under the Working Time Regulations, which is more generous in the UK with the 5.6 weeks, but it concerned the 4 weeks holiday that we get under the Working Time Directive. And he was found to be entitled to that for the duration of his employment with Sash Windows. And the reason for that was that it was found that the 2-year limit that was placed on unlawful deduction from wages claims by the coalition government, when we had the kind of run of holiday pay cases, and you know, the government was extremely worried about you know, how that was going to affect employers if these claims were sort of unlimited. And so they imposed 2-year backstop on unlawful deduction from wages claims as a result of this, kind to kind of almost plug the gap really for these holiday pay cases. But it was found that that legislation did not apply to Mr. King on the basis that it wasn't that he'd taken holiday and it just hadn't been calculated correctly. He'd never been given the opportunity to take holiday. So the courts, the lower courts in Mr. Smith's case, they relied on King but distinguished it and said, well, you know, Mr. King never had the opportunity to take holiday, so that's why the backstop doesn't apply to him, and that's why he was entitled to the Working Time Directive holiday. But the Court of Appeal disagreed and said that that distinction between Mr. King and Mr. Smith was artificial, and that effectively he should be allowed to carry over and accrue his entitlement to paid holiday under the Working Time Directive. The fact that he'd taken the holiday didn't satisfy that entitlement because he'd always taken it unpaid. So he just of his own volition booked holidays, but he hadn't been paid by Pimlico Plumbers for those holidays. So the Court of Appeal found that there is a single right to take paid leave, which Pimlico Plumbers had denied Mr. Smith by refusing to remunerate any holiday which Mr. Smith had taken, and that he was effectively advancing a claim for breach of that right, and that Mr. Smith could only lose that right if the employer could prove that he'd actually been given the opportunity to exercise his single right to paid annual leave. So that's the distinction here. So the Court of Appeal saying, no, it's not that it's different, that because in King he never took holidays, here Mr. Smith really, he took the holidays, but he wasn't paid for them. So Pimlico Plumbers hadn't effectively discharged their obligation. And on that basis, his holiday pay claim, as it stands in the Court of Appeal, has succeeded.
I was just going to pick up there. I think what's interesting for me is in the Court of Appeal, Lady Justice Simler made some very clear comments that she felt that the Bear line of cases, so Bear in Scotland was the case Lisa's talking about, that the coalition put this patch over, where they said if there's a break of 3 months where it was holiday pay was paid properly, there was a break in terms of the continuity of that claim. What Lady Justice Simler says is she prefers the approach of an Agnew, which is a case in Northern Ireland, which never actually got to the Supreme Court because it was settled before then, where it says that that break doesn't work effectively. It's manufactured to create a set of circumstances. So it makes, even though there's that 2-year stopgap for employees that are paid incorrectly, it makes it likely, I think, that the AT could go back in the event of holiday pay claims and rely on her comments to say this actually isn't fully resolved and they could go a different way. So holiday pay cases, notoriously difficult to bring given Bear in Scotland because every employee is different. But I think this probably simplifies the route for some trade unions to actually bring those claims. And I guess they will be looking for them. And the reason I raise that is because it has a much wider status than the worker status argument, as we say. But also, Lisa and I and the others in the team, we spend quite a lot of time looking at businesses which are being bought or sold. Holiday pay is consistently wrongly dealt with by a lot of the employers that we deal with varying hours arrangements and varying shift arrangements. And actually the liabilities are potentially quite large. So we see still a large element of misunderstanding from a lot of organizations as to how holiday pay needs to be dealt with and how it needs to be calculated in a lot of respects. I think the other thing for me that comes out of it is there have been questions in Parliament recently to the government about whether they are going to implement the Matthew Taylor report, the Good Work report. And for the first time, we've sort of seen them move away from when parliamentary time allows to saying, well, we've done a few things already. We've closed that gap. There's things that are happening. And I think there is a substantial risk now as time moves on that this government will move away from that. And we won't get any of the clarity or the increased protections that workers require. So it seems to me like these is going to be areas, I don't know whether you agree, Lisa, that are just going to morph with case law decision over time rather than by the government putting a firm hand on the tiller, really.
Yeah, I think it's actually really interesting because in Europe, they're going in the opposite direction. So in Europe, there is currently a directive that's kind of making its way through the European parliamentary system to give platform workers specific rights. So we're actually, this is an area where we are going to be diverging quite significantly from Europe. But the one thing that I do think this case does is it really ups the stakes in terms of getting self-employed status wrong, because previously there's always been a concern that, you know, one of the main risks with getting self-employment status wrong is a tax risk, which is a very similar test, but it is actually slightly different. But I think previously people have perhaps thought, oh well, you know, if the, you know, purported self-employed person takes their holiday, then, you know, we're, even if we don't pay for it, we're all right. Whereas actually this shows that if you get self-employment status wrong, and typically it happens when the relationship sours because these claims crystallize at the end of the relationship, so you part ways with what you consider to be a self-employed contractor, they bring a worker status claim, and then you could be hit with holiday pay going back all the way to when they started their engagement with you, or when the working time directive was implemented in the UK under the working time regs. So I think it does mean that the stakes have been increased considerably in the kind of worker status arena. And I think if you have got any self-employed consultant relationships where even if they did genuinely start out that way, sometimes the relationships morph over time. So it is just worthwhile having a look at those and considering whether they are still genuinely self-employed or whether actually we may have a bit of a accrued liability there, both from a potentially from a tax perspective and from a holiday pay and employment worker status perspective too.
I was going to say, what would be your kind of brief, given the implications and the stakes being raised, as you say, what would be your brief kind of tips? But I think you've probably just touched on it to kind of avoid getting in a mess. I mean, the tips to avoid getting in that situation. I think you've probably just touched on it, which is reviewing the relationship regularly.
Yeah, I think for me as well, you know, this case talks about Autocleanse and Belcher, which is now 10 years old and was the first of the cases where this sort of worker status thing was really drilled into by Patrick Elias, who's one of the leading employment lawyers of his generation. And he effectively said, if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it is a duck. And that's what we have. And I think I consistently see organizations who are overly reliant on documentation. And what he says is, you look behind, and what the case is, what Simler says is, you look behind what the documentation says and what the practice is. For me, the best judge of that is the employer or the purported client of these workers. And you've got to take a very realistic stance over it. The businesses that are framed on this, Uber, Deliveroo, Stewart Logistics, that they are all spending huge amounts of time and effort trying to prop up what is a working arrangement which is under constant attack. And I think for me, it is just not being overly reliant on the documentation. You've got to think about how you're set up and how the business is set up.
We've just had a question in, just I'm conscious of time for it, but the question's just, does the same apply for agency workers effectively, what we've just discussed?
Well, with an agency worker, you're insulated, aren't you? So as long as you've got an arm's length agency arrangement with a temping or other agency that's giving you as the end user, you're not responsible for that. If there's potentially IR35 and other issues that need to be factored into that sort of consideration. But it doesn't apply for agency workers because the agency is responsible for paying them and your relationship is with the agency. So there is a benefit to using an agency to insulate yourself from those type of claims.
Also with agency workers, it's quite common for them to have transparent rolled up holiday pay arrangements, which although technically we shouldn't be using, from the there is case law that basically establishes that where you've got a transparent rolled up holiday pay arrangement, you can use that as kind of evidence that holiday pay has been paid. So I think the answer really is no, it is different with agency workers for a number of reasons.
Lovely, thanks. Okay.
All right, so I think we're going to move on to, I don't know how to say this lady's name, Alette or Alite. Alette was a care assistant in a reasonably small family-run business. And the fact it was small and family-run is important, I think, to some of the decision-making that happened in this case. It's one of the line of cases we're starting to see from the pandemic response. It's first instance, so it's non-binding on tribunals that follow. But I think we are, as Lisa said at the beginning, starting to see patterns. And we've been on seminars with some of the barristers that we use in London who have talked about it. And their view is similar to ours in terms of what we're seeing in terms of where the points of attack have come from. So she worked in a residential care home for dementia sufferers that needed very close personal care. Couldn't avoid you couldn't have a 2 meter gap between working for people. And the case arose in the period pre-compulsory vaccination. So it was in that first Christmas of the pandemic. So it was December 2020 to January 2021. And what happened was that the care home organized a vaccination day for its residents and also for everybody that worked there. And Alette was initially happy to go along with what was needed, but the day before she realized it wasn't, it was a mandatory vaccination, and she said she didn't want to be vaccinated, and had a long call with Mr. McDonough, who is one of the directors of the nursing home, and her initial views were, I don't trust it, it's not been tested widely enough, my family and I have read a number of stories of conspiracy theories, and you can't guarantee my safety, so I'm not going to undergo the vaccination. So she declined. And what they did was they set up a disciplinary hearing and they said that they were going to treat her potential failure to follow a reasonable management instruction as gross misconduct grounds. During the hearing, she said that then another reason for not undergoing the vaccination was her Rastafarian beliefs. But ultimately, when she brought the claim, that wasn't part of her claim. So she didn't bring probably the better claim of the two that might have given her some grounds to bring the case. So what happened ultimately was that Mrs. Alette was dismissed. The employer relied on the welfare of the residents as being the predominant factor, but also tried to argue that it would have affected them in terms of their insurance, because after March 2021, they couldn't get public liability insurance for any COVID-related matters. And the employer's liability insurance was also potentially affected. And I think what was also in the tribunal's mind was that in the period between December, when the first vaccination date was put in place, it had to be actually delayed until January because there was a mass COVID outbreak in the home and a number of the residents unfortunately passed away. So the claim that she brought had to consider the unfair dismissal claim and also had to consider whether what the home had done was infringed her rights to a private life under the Human Rights Act. So even though the nursing home wasn't covered by the human rights provisions, in applying the law, the Employment Tribunal is. So what they found was that their Article 8 right was infringed, but it was necessary and proportionate at that time, and I think at that time is really important, to protect the health of the others, and that trumped that right effectively. So she only could proceed to the unfair dismissal claim, and she was found to have been fairly dismissed in the circumstances by the tribunal. What they said was that what her reasons for refusal were merely skeptical of the advice and not trusting the vaccination, and that was not enough to turn down what they thought in the circumstances, in a small home, doing that sort of work at the time that there was, in the teeth of the pandemic, if you remember that first Christmas, it was a reasonable management instruction which she chose not to follow. So for me, I think this is the high watermark. I don't think that many other circumstances have come since are likely to follow that. I think what we saw when the guidance was brought in about mandatory vaccination in this area was that the government had probably rowed back from a gross misconduct scenario and said there is a similar substantial reason scenario. So depending on the size and resources of the location, opportunities which didn't require vaccination would need to have been explored. It's very fact specific, but I think for me, the most interesting thing is it shows the levels of judicial sympathy. The public interest is seen to override those provisions. So it's an interesting decision. If, as Lisa says, we will see discrimination, we will see appellate cases come through. And there were people that were dismissed in relation to the government intention to have mandatory statutory requirements for vaccination before that legislation was effectively withdrawn on the 15th of March last year. So we justifying those dismissals, as long as you've gone through the process and as long as you followed the guidance, I think it would be very unlikely, unless there is some form of probably disability discrimination related ground, where the tribunal will go back against an employer who has acted reasonably and can show the proportionality and the legitimacy of the decisions that it made. So we'll come back to that probably in a moment when we talk about the other similar case which relates to the pandemic. Just moving on from there, is the case of Hope. And Hope, probably when I started in my career, would have been seen as a sort of outlier of a case. But actually, as we go on, and especially over the last probably 24, 36 months, we have seen, perhaps vexatious isn't necessarily the title I'd give to grievances, but we have seen people with multiple grievances and bringing grievance after grievance if they don't agree or don't like decision making within an organisation, and the difficulty that instills in terms of managing them. So this is an Employment Appeal Tribunal case, and it stemmed from a, as most of these cases do, a sort of personal falling out and pride being affected. So Mr. Hope was a senior policy advisor at the British Medical Association. He unfortunately saw an email that the director of policy at the BMA, somebody called Mr. Jethwa, sent to his boss, one of the senior executives at the BMA, Ms. Dunn, accusing Mr. Hope of being unprofessional and dismissive in the way that he dealt with some of the work that was needed for them. So Mr. Hope initially put in a grievance about that, wanting the BMA to give a clear indication that they did not stand by Mr. Jethwa's views. That wasn't upheld. Appeal was partially successful, but in effect he said, this is a personal issue between you and Mr. Jethwa. You need to sort things out between you. In fact, he was banging the two people's heads together with the outcome. And it also said, we feel we've used a lot of management time on sorting out something that could have been dealt with between the two of you. So the hope was that Mr. Hope and Mr. Jethwa would meet and rebuild their working relationship. However, things escalated. They didn't do that. And Mr. Hope turned on Ms. Dunn. He said she was excluding him from meetings. And he went to his line manager on numerous occasions saying he was framing grievances, but those grievances he wanted to be dealt with informally, not formally. They got fed up with that after several of these approaches and said, you either need to deal with them formally or you need to drop them and just get on with your work. And what he then did was raise another grievance, and they gave him a time limit to do that, to make that decision within. He then raised another grievance about being subjected to an arbitrary time limit in terms of determining what he wanted to do, plus raised further grievances about being excluded from more meetings. So this went on, and effectively they got to the end of their tether. They said, we're constituting a formal grievance hearing. He refused to attend that because he kept saying, I wanted to be kept informal, but you need to know about my concerns. And as a result of the outcome of that grievance hearing, it was referred for disciplinary action. They brought in an external counsel to run the disciplinary for them and effectively dismissed him for gross misconduct, even though they paid his notice, on the basis that he had behaved frivolously and vexatiously in terms of pursuing constant grievances. And he then brought a claim in relation to that. So there was no discrimination element to this. And I think if there had been some underlying medical condition or some race or other element, then the decision could have been very different. But basically, the employment tribunal held that they didn't think his dismissal was unfair, and that was ultimately upheld by the EAT. They felt that a disciplinary was appropriate given the nature of the conduct. And that was based on, in the AT's words, there being significant evidence of the effects his conduct had on the working relationship. So it's the conduct in relation to the working relationship which makes this a conduct dismissal rather than some other substantial reason dismissal as it could have been framed. And it looks like the external counsel who came in hedged his or her bets by saying it was gross misconduct because that's the route that had been approached, but also paying the notice, which you would be expected to do in another substantial reason dismissal. So the fairness wasn't affected by the characterization whether it should have been gross misconduct or not. The fact that it was conduct was sufficient for the tribunal to have made the findings that it did. And the fact that the effects the conduct had on the working relationship was so substantial or severe that allowed that decision to be made. So we are seeing more and more of these cases. We've dealt with several cases recently where there is grievance after grievance, or there's a grievance about the grievance process. And actually sticking to your guns and being very clear about what you will and won't do is the way in which we're having to manage those things. But we are seeing sort of keyboard warriors, as one colleague describes them, taking more and more approaches which are intended to either derail or to unsettle people, frequently with an end goal in mind of trying to get a settlement or an exit. So it's good to see the tribunal, I think, recognize this for what it was, which was Mr. Hope just could not put what had happened behind him and get on with his work and trust the people he worked with. So Hope is an interesting case and a good case to use if you're ever in that situation. I think the next case is the Tesco one, wasn't it, Lisa?
Yes, that's right. So this case is quite an interesting one because there was a different tack adopted in this case to what we've seen. So it came in the wake of the fire and rehire cases that we've seen in the media. So I know Clark's, British Gas, and lots of other big companies tried to make changes to terms and conditions of employment and have had quite a lot of flack in the media, to the extent that the government was asked whether they should be changing the law on collective consultation obligations. The government stepped back from that and instead asked ACAS to draft a code on changing terms and conditions of employment, and that is available on ACAS's website, and it basically stresses the importance of consultation. But this case was slightly different because Tesco had proposed some changes to terms and conditions of employment. but it was a specific group which had had some changes made to it previously between 2007 and 2009, and they had what was known as retained pay. And it was essentially a form of pay protection, really, that was agreed between the union Usdaw and Tesco, because between 2007 and 2009, Tesco had gone on an expansion programme, and that resulted in a number of sites closing and a number of other sites reopening. So what they did was they introduced this notion of retained pay because they wanted to incentivise employees that were being asked to relocate. They wanted to incentivise them to stay with Tesco and to relocate to these larger sites that Tesco was developing. And perhaps quite strangely, or certainly in my experience, quite strangely, at that time, Tesco made some quite bold claims to these employees that opted for retained pay. And they said things like that the retained pay provided protection for life. It was guaranteed for life, that, you know, if you were one of these employees that opted for retained pay, it would remain for as long as you were employed by Tesco in your current role, and your retained pay cannot be negotiated away by Tesco, Usdaw, or any Usdaw shop stewards. Then the collective agreement that incorporated these changes into the employment contract said that retained pay would be a permanent feature of individuals' contractual eligibility to this retained pay. So in my experience, that's really quite unusual and quite extreme in terms of the bold claims that were made by Tesco and Usdaw between 2007 and 2009 in respect of this retained pay. And clearly they'd obviously been very keen for employees to accept these new terms and conditions back in 2007 to 2009 to get them to move to these other sites. So the starting position, as most of you all know, when trying to change terms and conditions of employment, is that a contract, the easiest way to vary a contract is to do so by mutual agreement, because an employment contract really is a contract like most others. However, an employer that wants to vary terms where agreement hasn't been reached, the next best option for it is likely to be to terminate the contract on notice using the express notice provision clauses in the contract, and to offer re-engagement on the new terms at the end of that notice period, or to buy out the notice period. Employers can face unfair dismissal claims if the affected employees have qualifying service, but the risk is often taken by employers because they weigh up the commercials and they consider that actually weighing up that risk, that the dismissal and re-engagement is worthwhile. And provided they have got a sound business rationale for the proposed changes, and provided they go through an appropriate consultation process and an appropriate process to terminate those contracts and offer the new terms, then they may also well be able to defend any unfair dismissal claims. Dismissal may well be fair under the some other substantial reason ground under the Employment Rights Act. So it is quite common, and there's nothing unlawful about it in principle, provided that an appropriate process is followed, either under the to have a fair dismissal, but also under TULRCA, the Trade Union and Labour Relations Consolidation Act, if that is triggered because you've got 20 or more affected employees at any one establishment within a 90-day period. What's novel in this case is that Usdaw sought an injunction from the High Court. So they wanted to injunct Tesco to stop them from implementing the changes. And the reason for that was because they felt that if Tesco was able to dismiss and re-engage these employees, that wasn't an effective remedy for these employees, because if they had this protection for life, then actually the statutory cap would apply to an ordinary unfair dismissal claim, and the impact on their pay for a number of years meant that they didn't feel that was necessarily an effective remedy for them. So they sought an injunction in the High Court. And on the facts of the case, the objective intentions of the parties was found by the High Court to be relevant. So what they said was that although there is an express clause in the contract which entitled either party to terminate that contract, that in these particular set of circumstances, when you looked at the background and you looked at the wording of the collective agreement, that it couldn't have been the parties' intentions to enable Tesco to be able to exercise those express termination clauses for the purposes of effectively getting rid of the retained pay. So on that basis, the High Court said that it was necessary to imply a term into these contracts that Tesco's right to terminate the contract on notice could not be exercised for the purposes of getting rid of retained pay. So this is a really novel decision, and it's something that we've not seen before. And what the High Court said was they relied on a line of authorities, starting with a case called Aspden, which concerned permanent health insurance. And that line of cases, what that says is that it restricts the right of an employer to terminate a contract if the employer's power to terminate would frustrate the purpose for which the permanent health insurance was granted. So it was quite a novel decision in this case, and Tesco's been injuncted and can't make the changes. So, and it was found that an injunction was an appropriate remedy because the judge in this case, which was Ellen Bogan, said that she felt that it was right that actually the unfair dismissal would not have been an appropriate remedy. So we think that this case will probably have fairly narrow application, and we're not going to see this on a day-to-day basis, but certainly it is, well, I think for me it shows that unions are willing to flex their muscles and are starting to stand up and saying, you know what, we're not going to take these fire and rehires, and are looking at novel ways to protect their members' rights.
And I think for me it's also, you know, my training principal when I was a trainee back in Birmingham 25 years ago, the first thing he said to me was, you need to talk to your employers about being careful about making promises that they can not or won't keep. Because frankly, even if they're not of the sort of very concrete contractual nature that Lisa's just talked about, if you ever get to tribunal, they will always be played back to you. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid our political class has moved away from that, and where they constantly row back from things that they've said they will and will not do. But basically the expectation of employment judges, and especially an employment judge like Naomi Ellenbogen, who was a QC at Littleton Chambers and has done, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of employment tribunal and high court actions for employers. And she knows her way around the law and will do what is absolutely required to uphold it. And I think for me, it's an indication of the judicial thinking, and a P&O will just add fuel to that fire of the judges feeling that they need to make employers respect the law. And I think that this was a David and Goliath battle, and I think ultimately it's the right decision personally.
Yeah, and I think it is really unusual in the sense that I certainly have never seen employers previously say, you know, this is guaranteed for life and things like that. But you know, there was, they had said that. So yeah, totally agree, Chris.
Yeah, I don't think that a lot of employers say it as clearly as Tesco did on multiple occasions as they do. Yeah. But you do need to be careful, especially if you've got a trade union, of when you're doing negotiations or you're looking to change terms and perhaps bargain off one against another, to make sure that everybody very clearly understands the nature of the bargain and how long that will apply for.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next case we've got is the case of Acatatis and Fortuna Group London Limited. And in this particular case, we're going back to the pandemic. And this was a case at the height of the pandemic. So it concerned the period of March and April 2020, if we can all cast our minds back to that lovely period of time. And Mr. Acatatis, he worked for Fortuna Group, which sells and distributes PPE. And his job entailed accepting daily deliveries, entering details onto the system, photographing and organising promotional materials. And because the business provided PPE, it was they were all considered to be key workers. And so the business remained open during that kind of early stage of the pandemic where a lot of businesses closed. So in March and April 2020, Mr. Akatatis asked his employer to work from home or asked to be furloughed because he said that he had concerns about getting on public transport to get to work, and he also had concerns about working in the office. Fortuna Group denied his request and said that due to the nature of his work and how busy they were, that they couldn't justify furloughing him. They said as a compromise that he could use his holidays or take a period of unpaid leave if he wanted to, but ideally, really, they did need him to come into work because they were extremely busy. Mr. Akatatis declined those offers and requested again to be furloughed. And ultimately, Fortuna Group made the decision to dismiss him because Mr. Akatatis had short service with the company. So Mr. Akatatis brought a claim under Section 101E of the Employment Rights Act because he had short service, so he wasn't able to bring an ordinary unfair dismissal claim against the company. And that section 100 and the subsection 1E provides that an employee will be automatically unfairly dismissed if the principal reason for the dismissal is that in circumstances of danger, which the employee reasonably believed to be serious and imminent, and which he could not reasonably have been expected to avert, he took appropriate steps to protect himself and other persons from that danger. So he brought the claim in the Employment Tribunal and the claim was dismissed. Whilst the tribunal said that it was prepared to accept that Mr. Akatatis did have a reasonable belief in the serious and imminent danger, it held that he had not taken appropriate steps to protect himself from that danger. His demands to be furloughed or work from home did not qualify as appropriate steps in the Employment Tribunal's view. However, what I do think is quite interesting about this case is that when reading the judgment, I think the tribunal's view was coloured by the fact that there was nothing that suggested from the papers that Mr. Akatatis had actually expressed any concerns to his employer about a lack of safety in the workplace. And I think that coloured their view. And I think that's symptomatic of the first instance decisions that we're seeing, that certainly the trend seems to be that where an employer has acted reasonably and has taken appropriate steps during the height of the pandemic to try and protect its workers, that tribunals are kind of finding in their favour, whereas where employers have behaved unreasonably, they're tending to find the other way. So there does seem to be that kind of sort of moral divide almost, I would say. But it's only a first instance decision, but I thought it was an interesting one because it does show where the lines seem to be drawn. But as Chris says, I do think that it may well be different in the case of discrimination complaints, and we're yet to see many of those coming through yet, but we'll watch this space. So the final case that we'd like to talk about today is the case of Mrs. Hodgson and Martin Design Associates Limited. And Martin Design Associates was an electrical and mechanical designers. And Mrs. Hodgson was an office manager, and she had worked for Martin Design Associates for over 11 years. Her son was diagnosed with a very aggressive form of leukemia, and he was receiving chemotherapy in hospital. So Mrs. Hodgson made an informal request to work remotely from his bedside. Without investigation, the managing director of Martin Design Associates refused the request, and he said that she couldn't look after a son and work by his bedside, that effectively it was one or the other. Her views were given no credit whatsoever. Mrs. Hodgson was told that she could take annual leave followed by a period of unpaid leave. There was no discussion about compassionate leave. As a result of this, she submitted a formal flexible working request, and perhaps unsurprisingly, that was also rejected. So as a result, she resigned from her employment in July 2019. So she brought a number of claims, but the most interesting ones were that she brought a constructive dismissal claim against Martin Design Associates as a result of the manner in which her flexible working request was dealt with. And she also brought a sex discrimination complaint because she said that other male colleagues had been allowed to work from home where she hadn't. And in particular, there'd been comments made by the MD of Martin Design Associates, where he sort of expressed the view that he knew better what she needed, whereas that hadn't been the case with male comparators. And she also brought a discrimination claim by association, and it was actually a harassment claim on the basis that she had been harassed as a result of some comments that had been made and the associative link to her disabled son. She succeeded with a number of her claims. She didn't succeed with a, she had brought also a disability discrimination claim about herself, but she didn't get over the hurdle of herself being disabled. But she did succeed with her constructive dismissal claim. And it was found that the way in which the flexible working request had been dealt with and the fact that it hadn't been dealt with reasonably in the tribunal panel's view did seriously damage the implied term of mutual trust and confidence. The panel also found that the respondents' actions amounted to direct sex discrimination, and they found, as a matter of fact, that male colleagues were granted permission to work remotely when she wasn't. And the most interesting point is, legally in my view, was that her claim for disability discrimination by association relating to her son's disability succeeded. There was found to have been harassment in the form of unwelcome conduct relating to her son's disability, which the tribunal found had created a hostile working environment for Mrs. Hodgson, because they did things like, for example, suggested that her role was redundant. And as a result of that, for the harassment claim, she was awarded an injury to feelings award of £10,000 plus interest. So we thought that this was quite an interesting case because it's quite current in terms of working from home arrangements becoming increasingly prevalent. And we're also seeing an increase in the amount of flexible working requests that employers are facing. So I guess a bit of a cautionary tale really in terms of when dealing with flexible working requests, even though we've got the kind of list of statutory grounds for the time being, that it is still incumbent on employers to, even if there aren't any discrimination grounds, to still carry out reasonable investigation and to deal with flexible working requests reasonably, or otherwise it could amount to a breach of the implied duty of implied term of mutual trust and confidence. So we thought it was quite an interesting one from that perspective.
Yeah, I agree absolutely, and I think it's an area where we see some employers really get fixated on the flexible working regs and just don't think about the discrimination issues. They don't actually manage the most risky aspect of the process properly. So always thinking about the reasons why somebody's asking for it. Is there a disability or is there a sex-related consideration? They're the two main areas we look at, and thinking about how you would justify that if somebody didn't like the response is really important, because yeah. The hurdle is really high to get over in terms of proportionality and legitimacy.
Absolutely.
So I'm slightly mindful of the fact we said we finished by 10:30 and we're rapidly approaching that, if not slightly on 10:30 already. We had a couple of questions. I don't think there's anything else, Roland, was there, that people have raised? I think we've sort of tried to give practical views as we go. But if we've not covered anything you wanted to have chat to us about, you know, you have our contact details. We'd be happy to have a chat to you about anything. Happy to get any feedback on these sessions. Because our aim is to run these quarterly, the next one being in June. And we also, in the interim period, have a number of practical masterclasses, which between us, Roland, and Amy Surgison, are run still online at the moment. We're going to do more face-to-face events. But if you're interested in any of those, please visit our events page on our website and do sign up for them. And you can also just email us if you want to be added to our mailing list for things that are coming up. If you're in Cumbria, we are running a session at Carlisle Racecourse on the 6th of April, where there is still capacity. So if anybody wants to come and talk about employment law and immigration law in more detail, then please do let us know, and we'll happily send you the details for that. And I think they're also on the events page as well. But otherwise, thank you for bearing with us this morning, and hopefully you've got something from that. Practically, our aim is to try and give you something that at least allows you to look at your business and how things help you manage your employment issues there. So thank you very much. Have a good day, and hope to speak to you soon. Thank you.